This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Shao Eek. One in three women worldwide experience some form of violence in their lives, and most of this is physical, sexual or emotional abuse, either from an intimate partner or a non-partner. Now, aside from the physical impact, the abuse also causes mental and emotional trauma that is often hidden from sight, but can leave long-term scars in the survivors. So today, joining me, Meena Patel, Senior Associate from Architects of Diversity and a gender rights activist. And we're going to discuss women's mental vulnerability when they experience violence through the rocky process of reaching out for help, as well as when they're on the path to recovery. And this is, of course, in conjunction with International Women's Day. And we want to continue putting the focus on as many women's issues as possible throughout the month of March. Thank you so much for joining me for this very important conversation, Meena.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I think perhaps we could start with trying to understand, and I think we all in society have preconceived notions about violence and abuse. From your years of work, working with women who have come through abuse and gender-based violence, what exactly does abuse look like?
So here's the thing. Whenever we talk about any kind of abuse, domestic violence, rape and all, we always think about the physical aspect of it, right? The bruises, the physical abuse. But that's the thing. We are often stopped there. We don't think about all the other kind of abuses that also may happen that we can't see. So things like verbal, emotional abuse, things like mental, psychological abuse, financial abuse, and also society abuse in the sense of, you know, survivors. For an example, if you talk about domestic violence, what often happens is that, you know, the survivors are not allowed to go out to talk to their friends, or their relationship with their own family members would deteriorate. And all of this then would affect how they seek help after that, you know, because if they don't have any more friends, who are they supposed to go to? So all of this are the various different kinds of abuse that happens. So if I can share with you one of the cases that I've actually handled and how in one case you can actually see all this different kind of abuse happening. So in this one case, of course, it was a mother with children, and the mother was being abused physically and also sexually. So mother was being abused physically. Her daughter was being abused sexually by the stepfather. So when I was talking to her about, okay, you know, like, let's get help, she would tell me that, you know, she doesn't have any finances to even go to the police station because she's always been locked in the house and she doesn't go out to work. She doesn't have any money on herself to go to the police station. Like, that's like the most basic thing. And then I was like, okay, what about friends or family or neighbors who are able to help you out? No, that was also a challenge because she was always locked in the house. And each time when I would talk to her about, okay, look, like, can we do this? Like, I can try and get someone to, you know, accompany her to the police station. And she would often pause and think back because there was also a lot of verbal abuse, like threatening her, like the perpetrator would threaten her that, you know, if she tries to do anything, he would harm the kids. Or, you know, he would harm her even more than what he's already doing. So all of this played a role in her journey to even try to seek justice or any kind of support. And this is what happens in a lot of cases when it comes to abuse.
What about perpetrators of abuse who gaslight and try and manipulate the situation until women themselves don't even realize they're being abused or are being constantly told, I'm only doing this because I love you?
Yes. So when I talk about abuse, there's always the cycle of abuse, right? There's always the honeymoon period. And then when the abuse happens. And after that comes a point of, you know, reconciling. But the reconciling would be, you know, like, I'm doing this because I love you. Or you made me do this to you because you didn't listen to what I say. And then there's another honeymoon period. So that cycle will continue over and over again, right? And that's one of the problems that we also have, that, you know, a lot of our cultural stuff or things that happen around us kind of romanticize this kind of abuse as well. So, you know, we have movies, we have dramas, we have songs that would kind of show abuse is okay. It's fine. It's part of a relationship to be abused. And if you're not abused, means that the person doesn't love you that much in the first place, right? And that is a problem, because that kind of perpetuates that cycle over and over again, that women don't even see the abuse they're going through as an abuse. They just think that it's normal. It's a part of life.
Yes, so that roller coaster of emotions, right? And I can imagine women just never feel secure about where they are in this relationship, and they must be constantly questioning who they are, and they're questioning their own emotions. Are they even right to feel unsafe? What do women go through, the emotional process?
So in the emotional process, what often happens is that women would feel that this is my protector, like, you know, this is my partner, this is my, you know, intimate partner, and for a lot of times this is my spouse, this is my husband, right? And like, so of course there's the entire aspect of it's embarrassing to talk about this kind of issues to public, you know, there's that fear about how would everyone perceive them as a family. And then there's also the entire part of, you know, maybe this is my mistake, that, you know, I didn't listen to his words. I didn't please him. I didn't satisfy him. And he's unhappy with me. So I need to up my game and show my love better. So there's a lot of questions on self-worth that also comes in here. Mm-hmm. And there's also the maternal instinct as well. You know, if they have children there, of course, it's like, you know, I don't want to make my kids live without a father. Mm-hmm. And that also would affect them going out to reach for any kind of support. So in the emotional aspect, that there's a lot of self-worth questions. There are a lot of questions within themselves. Like, are they even worthy to go ask any help? Would anyone even help me in the first place? And, you know, this is my spouse and I love, and whatever it is, I still love him.
Yeah. And typically, how long could something like this go on for?
It can go on for years. It can really go on for years. And there are many cases where they would still choose to stay with their spouse. But because of that cycle, the cycle of abuse, right? Like, they are abused. So at that moment, they may be like, okay, you know what? I need to get help. I need to do something. And some may reach the level of making a police report. But then what happens is that slight action of emotions would come in, that reconciliation actions may happen, and then the servers will pull back the case. So they will drop the police report. And then that also makes it difficult for future cases, because even the police then will be like, okay, you know, like, we tried to help her and she'll drop the case. So if she comes to us again, do we still want to help them? Because, you know, like, that is the cycle that happens. So there's so many cases that it's happened for years. There's so many survivors who still continue to live with their abusive partners.
And we'll pick up on that point later, right? And in terms of some of the misconceptions about survivors who choose or feel forced to stay in the relationship. But, you know, in the case of where police or any other agency who may be trying to help, but the survivors change their minds, they're pulling back, is it still worth helping them?
Of course, it's always worth helping survivors, right? Because whatever it is a question of their life. Sometimes they're ready for it. Sometimes they're not 100% ready. And that's okay. Whenever a survivor reaches out, a task of any agency or as any human being, as any friends, you know, our job is to be there for them whenever they are ready to whatever extent that they want to take the case forward. If they want to drop it, that's up to them. But they need to know that if it happens again, if and when they are ready, there are people around them who would help them. Because we don't want survivors to also then feel like, oh, you know, the next time I can't reach out to anyone anymore because they don't trust me. So then they would stay there even further. So that's something that we do not want to continue.
So we've looked at the emotional impact, the kind of the vicious cycle of feelings, the shame, guilt, and poor self-worth, embarrassment, fear that they're going through. How have you seen this manifest in their behaviours changing, even their personalities changing to some extent?
So a lot of survivors would, to some extent, cut their conversations or whatever social friends that they have, right? So a lot of them are stuck at home, so they stop talking to their friends because of all this fear of, you know, what if the perpetrator finds this kind of messages, like, oh, you know, I'm telling someone else about these issues. So that's that fear would, of course, also kind of cut relationships that they already have. So they themselves would continuously live in fear. They would stop conversations with outside people. Some of them would, you know, start self-harming. Then these are some of the cases that I've seen, right? What would also happen is that, you know, they would go into depression. A lot of them, even their physical appearance would change a lot. You know, sometimes either some of them would stress eat or they would stress not eat, depending on how their coping mechanism is. Some would just really go like such a big change in themselves. But of course, they would still, in many aspects, follow whatever the perpetrator wants. So keep into that cycle, but it's just they themselves with no one around them.
We'll come back and continue this discussion, and we'll look at society's misconceptions about gender-based violence. I know you've talked a little bit about sort of what people tend to perceive as being gender-based violence, that it seems to be people think that it's limited to physical and sexual violence. But I want to explore a little bit more in terms of how society's misconceptions hold women back from seeking help and from being able to understand what they are going through as well. And of course, we'll continue the conversation to look at what women can do to seek help, that emotional journey as well when they are making a police report, trying to escape the abuse, still so much more that women have to go through. So in conjunction with International Women's Day, we are discussing the mental trauma of gender-based violence. I'm speaking to Meena Patel, Senior Associate at Architects of Diversity and a Gender Rights Activist. We'll be right back on Health and Living, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Shao-Ik. Joining me, Meena Patel, Senior Associate at Architects of Diversity and a longtime gender rights activist. A really great guest to be speaking to in conjunction with International Women's Day and the whole month of March, where I hope we can continue to highlight women's issues. Today, the spotlight is on the mental trauma that survivors of gender-based violence go through. Meena has already shared how gender-based violence goes beyond domestic physical violence or rape or any form of sexual violence. It can also involve verbal, emotional, mental, psychological, even financial abuse, all ways in which an intimate partner especially could control a woman and make her, you know, completely at the perpetrator's beck and call, and not feel that she is her own person anymore, not feel that she's able to escape an abusive relationship or reach out for help. So what do women often hear from society about gender-based violence, Meena? Apart from the fact that, you know, there are so many more forms of violence than people often realize, I guess society also has notions about whose fault, quote unquote, it may be, what women are doing right or wrong in their relationship, and how do these notions make women themselves feel when they're trying to work out, am I in an abusive relationship?
So often, but one of the things that we always hear, that, you know, whenever there's any kind of abuse, for an example, if it's domestic violence, right? So often it'll be like, oh, it's a family matter. And therefore, a lot of people would not want to touch issues of domestic violence. To some extent, some police officers also may look at it like, you know, everyone has their own personal interpretation of certain issues, right? And for a lot of people, they would actually think of domestic violence as a family matter. Like, we don't want to catch out the pikai in orang. Mm. But when there's issues of abuse, you know, it is everyone's problem. Everyone needs to be involved. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. And then, of course, there is the entire victim blaming part that happens, right? So it's often said that, oh, you know, the wife isn't submitting enough, or they're not making the husband happy, or it is their fault, therefore they're being abused.
And we hear these narratives being perpetrated by people who really shouldn't be saying it. For example, people in positions of power as well.
Or sometimes even within the family. And that would make the survivor feel even more worse because for them it's like, you know, this is my family. This is people who should be my support. And when my own support says that it's my fault, is it really my fault? So it ends up being that all that kind of mindset as well. And I remember one of the most disturbing things that I used to hear always whenever it comes to sexual abuse, especially sexual abuse towards minors, like cases of incest and stuff. Often the kind of response that I would hear is, well, it's better it's within the family than a stranger committing that to them.
That's horrible.
And that's so horrible. That's so sickening. Because, okay, to some extent, one may think, like, okay, if it's a stranger, yes, you know, you made a report, like you'll never have to see them again. But if it's within your family, imagine the kind of trauma you're going through every other day. Or if it's a distant relative, then it's like every other, you know, like festival occasions and you're looking at the perpetrator who molested you before, who abused you before, and you have to look at them every single time. And often when it's your own family member, there's also a lot of, you know, emotional blackmails that come in, like, oh, you know, you can't make a police report about this. You can't take any action about this because, you know, this is your family member. Are you sure you're going to do that to your own family member? And everyone in the family would suddenly have some say in this, preventing the survivor from taking any action. And emotionally, of course, that would affect the survivor a lot. Because, you know, you have no support. Your people close to you is saying no to making any reports or even checking in or even telling you, like, okay, you know what? Let's make sure you get some kind of counseling support. Talk to someone about it. No. Survivors are actually asked to forget about it, like it never happened. And everything is normal. And it happens quite a lot, actually. A lot of these cases are not reported because there is a shame in reporting it. So behind the scenes, these issues happen a lot. And at some point, like if it's a child, when they grow up, it would affect their relationship with their future, whoever their current partner may be, or they won't have trust in relationships at all. There will be a lot of, you know, questions about their own body. Like, do they own their own body? Because, well, people have violated their own body. Family members have violated their own body. So how do they move on from there? So their trauma will go through for years as people grow up. Even if domestic violence, it's husband hitting the wife, the children seeing that. So when they grow up, either they would say, like, okay, yes, my father is to my mother, therefore it's okay if I'm a boy, it's okay for me to abuse women because that's how my family used to see it. Or if I'm a girl, like, oh, my mother was being abused, okay, that's how a relationship should be. And therefore they would be okay to be abused by their moving forward partners, right? Mm. So the cycle never ends if no support is given.
Mm. And that's why we talk about the dangers of violence being intergenerational, that the cycle will just continue to perpetuate if survivors aren't given the support and their children, if the children have been witnessing the abuse, aren't given that kind of post-traumatic support as well. You said earlier that in many cases, very tragically, survivors choose to stay with their spouse despite recognizing that this is an abusive relationship. And that's such a complex issue that choice is not really independent choice. It's a forced choice. They just have no other way out. But there's also this notion that, you know, if you continue to stay in this relationship, it's because, you know, you're weak, you know, you're not trying hard enough. How would you respond to those kinds of attitudes? And how do we approach this idea of women needing that internal mental strength to reach out for support?
So, like I mentioned, right, when a survivor is going through all this kind of abuse, they already have all these barriers. You know, they no longer have friends. They don't have the finances to, you know, like, even go to a police station, even go to the hospital to get a medical report to show that there was any kind of abuse. And that would also then affect, you know, not having finances to even hire a lawyer. Legal fees is expensive. So there's already all these kind of barriers. So it is understandable for survivors to need to take that time to, you know, prepare themselves emotionally, mentally to, you know, to go out. Because once you go out, the survivors already know that there will be all these kind of things said to them. They know that they will have all these obstacles when they finally decide to go out, obstacles from their own family members or, you know, in-laws side, saying things like, you know, how can you make a report against the person who's been, you know, feeding you, putting clothes on you, you know, having a shelter over your head, paying for your food, you're being ungrateful. So they have to deal with that kind of, you know, obstacles. And then there's also obstacles of sometimes getting authorities who are not that helpful, or sometimes, you know, having a case where it's, oh, we don't see enough evidence of abuse and therefore, you know, you can't proceed. And then what happens to them? Where do they go? Are they going to end back up with the perpetrator? Or, you know, and all, like, once again, all that takes finances, right? If you want to stay out, stay away, you want to separate, you need money to find a different place to stay, a shelter. Like, yes, we do have, you know, civil societies in Malaysia do provide shelters, but it's not in every single state. Mm-hmm. So it depends on where you're at, then what kind of support that you have there. So all this, there's so many barriers. So it's definitely understandable for a survivor to, you know, take a longer time in preparing oneself to take the next action. And as a society, our job is also to, you know, support them in being ready, provide them with that, okay, you know, what can you do? These are some possible suggestions, but always remember at the end of the day, the step needs to be taken by the survivor. So the survivor needs to be ready to take what steps they want to take.
Mm.
And being ready will take some time for them to get ready.
So, for instance, if I'm a friend and somehow a survivor is able to reach out to me and talk to me about what she's going through, and I want to help her reach that state of mental preparedness, what could I say?
So, as friends, of course, the most number one most important thing to do is listen to them. Don't judge them. Don't say things like, oh, you know, just get out. Or, you know, like, tell them things like, oh, you know, you're weak for still staying there. You should be stronger and this and that. Like, don't judge. Just, like, first and foremost, listen. Second thing is give them the options. Tell them, okay, this place can provide you this kind of help. There's that place to provide that kind of help. So they can then envision what and where are they going. So as a friend, it's important for us to give them that access, that information. And another thing that I realized that friends should really help doing is to help record this kind of stuff. Like, in terms of write down each time that they say that they were abused, where, how, all write all of that kind of information down. Because all of these documentations is super important when you go make a police report, right? And what happens with a survivor often is that if a survivor doesn't write down the chronology of what's happening, and sometimes it is difficult for the survivor to do that because they're staying with the perpetrator. Like, what if the perpetrator were to find whatever notebook, wherever they're writing stuff like this? Mm-hmm. So as a friend, it's important for you to help document which dates did abuse happen, what kind of abuse, was there a triggering point, was there any physical bruises, if able to take picture, keep those evidence. So as a friend, there's a lot of role to play. And there's also this other thing that friends or maybe direct neighbors can do. So sometimes when I used to handle cases of domestic violence, there were often times when neighbors would ask, like, you know, I know my neighbor's house or the house around my neighborhood, there is domestic violence happening there, or children are being abused. What can a neighbor do? So of course, number one is when the abuse is happening, to call the police. Or number two is you can try and delay the stuff, right? So you know abuse is going on there. You can just go knock on the door and just say, like, hey, I want to borrow something. So kind of stop that abuse while it's happening. Mm-hmm. But of course, you know, do not take actions like directly confronting the perpetrator. Like, you know, that's not something safe to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always best to inform the police when things like this is happening.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, sometimes actions can be a bit slow, but you know, at the end of the day, you're making this kind of reports. You have all of these things jotted down. Okay, this date, I'm hearing what stuff happening. that need, what's going on. So all of this is documented, and documentation is really key in making any reports on any type of gender-based violence.
So the police report would be the first step in terms of accessing the system to get help.
Yes.
And all those, the chronological recording of each incident of abuse as much as possible. What else should women be prepared for when they really take that step towards getting help?
So one of the easy ways for survivors, like easy access, would be to get in touch with any women's rights organization. So organizations like All Women Action Society, AWAM, or WAO, or if you are at northern region of Malaysia, then there's Women's Center for Change, WCC. So there's all these different organizations at different parts. So of course, when you get in touch with them, because they have worked with the police, so they know the process of making a police report, because sometimes survivors are afraid, because you know, you don't know what must be included in a police report, what mustn't be included, and you know, like how to write a police report. So it's always good to have someone accompany you. And all of these women's rights organizations do accompany survivors to go make a police report and guide them, like, okay, how is a report meant to be made? And these organizations also do provide mental health support, counseling, not just for survivors, but also their children. Not just as women's rights organizations, there are a lot of other mental health organizations out there that also do provide counseling support. And what's great is that since MCO, since the COVID, the pandemic happened, what's been happening is that this kind of counseling support now can be done virtually or even via phone. So at least it's accessible in that sense, right? So those are kind of support that you can get. And this support would definitely help a lot for survivors to know that, you know, yes, there are these people who are going to help me out. They will help figure out shelters, if survivors need shelters, if there is a fear of, you know, the perpetrator finding where the survivor is and coming to abuse, all these organizations know how to, you know, speak to the police to get any protection orders to ensure that the perpetrator does not come anywhere close to the survivor or the kids. And all of these steps are important and crucial for survivors to know. And the only way they can know it is when they get in touch with women's rights organization.
And as you said, legal fees will come in at some point. What kind of support is available for women in that aspect?
So when it comes to legal fees, of course, women's rights organizations do have their own, you know, legal contacts as well. People who can help out with these kind of cases. And of course, you know, and there are firms that help out pro bono in these kind of cases. And it's great to have that as well, to know that these kind of support resources are there when survivors need it. So which is why it's that process of reporting these cases are so important, so that, you know, all of this, you know, steps can step in at the same time. Because if a survivor, for example, chooses not to go make a police report, but just to, you know, go through lawyers and all that, they need to have that kind of context. And when you approach lawyers directly, sometimes the fees can be quite high, depending on what you intend to do.
All right. You mentioned that mental health support or some form of counselling, whether it's provided by a mental health provider or within the women's you know, organisations, that's very important. But walk us through what a woman would experience during counselling. In you know, for some, there may be an idea that you're just going to make me talk about all the problems again and again. I don't want to do that. You know, what exactly happens and why would it be beneficial?
So when it comes to all this kind of trauma, whether it's a fresh trauma or it's an old wound, right? Something that happened years ago. So there is a need to process all of that. And so when we talk about counselling, we're not just like repeating the case that happened over and over again, but it's also to help survivors, you know, talk about the emotions that they went through, you know, all the barriers that they may have had, like their emotional barriers, thinking that at times that, you know, they deserved it was their fault, to actually process all of that. And that's important, right? For them to rebuild their self-worth. And that's why counselling and mental health support is super important. Because if they don't have that aspect, chances of them returning to an abusive environment again is high. Because if they don't deal with it, so that's why it's important for them to deal with that emotional baggage that they have, not just for themselves, but also for children. If there are any children involved, it's also important for children to talk about it. So, of course, a lot of these organizations, when they provide counseling for children, of course, there needs to be various different ways to get children to talk about issues. There's color therapy, there's drawings, and whatever is most suited for that child, depending on what age the child is. Because even for them, it's important to talk about what they saw. You know, seeing their father now no longer part of the picture, what does it mean? They would have a lot of questions. So it's good to have this kind of mental health support.
And it's not a one-off thing. It's a process, right?
It's a process. But saying that, like, even it's a process, sometimes it does become a bit difficult for some survivors, because sometimes they would come for a few times, go missing for some time, and then come back again. But it should not be a problem, because we understand sometimes survivors do need to take some time away from all of this, or sometimes they are relapsing into anything. But whenever they are ready to go through counseling again, that service is there for them.
Would these counseling services be helpful when women encounter obstacles in their journey of getting help, whether it's at the sort of the police level or the legal level? I mean, I'm sure it's not a straightforward journey. You know, what kind of obstacles might they continue to encounter, and would counseling help them have that resilience to continue?
So I have seen cases where counseling really helps build that resilience, especially when, because going through a domestic violence case for when it's being mentioned in court, all of that would take some time. Then, for example, they want to go through divorce. Divorce takes some time too. When I talk about divorce, so child custody. So there's a lot, the process when it comes to legal part, it is a long process. But that's why all this support is important. So once they go through counseling, so there is that emotional aspect that they're talking and they're solving. But when there is all these barriers in the sense of, okay, the legal process, there is some bumps and all. So that part, it may not be the counselors who assist that much. That would be more on the lawyer's side. But as long as the lawyers, you know, are aware of the entire dynamics, lawyers do know what to say, what to do. We do have some excellent lawyers that work on gender-based violence cases. So they know the kind of challenges that would come up. And it's also important to ensure at this time, survivors do get that kind of support from their own friends. Because counselors will not accompany survivors to the court when court proceeding is going on. So that kind of support, surrounding support is crucial. So I remember once accompanying a survivor of rape, and she was a minor. And the case was ongoing in court, but she wanted to be there to hear the judgment. Like she wanted that for herself, to know that the perpetrator is going to be, you know, sentenced. Like she was a minor, but she was so strong that she wanted to hear it for herself to kind of know that, you know, justice has been served. And at that time, she had family, but she didn't have any friends. Mm-hmm. To some extent, certain topics, you need friends to talk about it. And she actually requested if I could follow her to the court. And I accompanied her to the court. So she was telling me about, you know, she's a minor, she doesn't know what to do next with her life. And that's why it's important to actually have people around who can talk to you, just like career suggestions, technical and vocational schools that they may go to or furthering their studies, but just someone to talk to about, you know, maybe sometimes conversation can be super simple as, you know, hobbies, whatever it takes to kind of get your mind off things. And also to talk about what's next with this case. So, like, yes, mental health support, but at the same time, they also do need friends around them. And so if anyone here who's listening today are friends of, you know, any survivors of abuse, like, always make sure to message and check in on them, you know, ask them out for drinks. Like, they may be survivors of abuse, like, years ago, but that doesn't mean that face is ever over from their mind. It would be something that they often think about. It would be something that, you know, comes back at the smallest trigger points sometimes. So that support system is super crucial.
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, when we're talking about being able to reach some sort of resolution in escaping and getting closure to this abusive relationship, even what's next is an emotional journey in itself, right? And I've spoken to survivors who have been in that relationship for so long, being a homemaker, that, you know, how do they then support themselves now and their child? And just those thoughts of, you know, how do I navigate the road forward now?
Yeah. So that's where a lot of the women's rights organizations do a great job at supporting survivors when it comes to situations like that, right? Like I know of this one shelter in Rimbau, where what they do is that they help take care of the child so the mother can find a work again. So they are able to slowly stand on their own feet, right? As compared to putting the child into a shelter home, putting the mother into a shelter home, and then just staying there and not doing anything. Because there is that need to be independent by yourself, just to empower themselves, right? Mm. So there are all these, you know, shelters out there that do support survivors so that they can start standing on their own feet. Well, sometimes I wish that the government would have some of these kind of programs where they help survivors, you know, empower survivors, right? That's something that's kind of lacking currently. Hopefully someday we'll see better plannings and such as compared to, you know, just having shelters, because shelters are just, it can't cope and it doesn't solve the problem. So it is a temporary step, and it's great that temporary shelter is there. But there needs to be a bigger plan, what happens after shelter.
Mm. And I hope, you know, as much as we can talk about it, we'll continue to talk about it. We hope that somebody's listening, right? And Mina, when we continue to talk openly about gender-based violence and to give a voice to what women are going through and their vulnerability, and this is a bit of a personal question, I guess, after so many years of working in this area, do you feel jaded or do you think we're getting somewhere?
That is a very personal question. But yes, like I've had times where, you know, dealing with all these kind of cases, sometimes it makes it difficult for myself. Like there are times where, you know, I just can't sleep at night thinking about all this, you know, women who are being abused, who have not gotten any support. They're still there. What if something happens tonight? You know, what about teenagers who are being molested by their own family members? I'm like, you know, they're still in that house. Yeah. And what if something is going on tonight? Like, so the kind of trauma,
yes, that you face, yeah,
that someone who's supporting faces, it's definitely there. But at the end of the day, like, I know I can never tell myself, like, you know what, this is just, it's just impossible to deal with this. And you know, I should just maybe detach myself from all this kind of stuff. But it's just impossible to do that, right? Because you know this issue is going on. And we've just not reached that level where, you know, no, you know, there won't be any kind of abuse and everyone is equal. Like, we're still far from that. And whoever who is able to support should definitely try and support any survivors. And I also just want to put it out there, like, whenever we talk about any kind of abuse, right, it's all about power, because power is what causes abuse. And I just want to remind people that we always talk about women who are being abused, but I've dealt with some really bad cases where men are being abused. Because it's like, we're talking about power, right? So men who are being abused, and for some of them, they have nowhere to go because it's a further question of embarrassment and what kind of a man gets abused by women and all that kind of stuff. So that is also quite challenging. And what always breaks my heart is minors and children who are being abused, because they're so young that they would absorb all of this, and that cycle of abuse that would go on and on as they grow up.
Yeah.
It's really dark, and you never know if they would ever get out of it. So yeah, it is really very difficult.
A final message, perhaps, for International Women's Day, Mina?
So, in conjunction with International Women's Day, I just want to tell all women out there that it doesn't matter what you're going through. Everyone has their own battles. You have the support from people around you. You know, it can be people around you, friends that you still may have contact, or it can be from complete strangers. And everyone is here to help you if and when you want it. So always reach out. Never feel like you're alone. All women have the strength to move mountains. So just reach out if you're going through anything. So you can definitely follow me on social media and I can try and help out if I can. But if you ever need anyone to talk to, you know, just reach out.
Thank you so much, Mina. I've been speaking to Mina Patel, Senior Associate at Architects of Diversity and a gender rights activist, about the mental trauma that survivors of gender-based violence go through and how they can reach out for help in conjunction with International Women's Day. You've been listening to Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.